Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Thursday, April 15th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody.
You know, it's been a hectic day here, another one, and great day for gold. The markets went crazy today, and, you know, it's just, it's a good thing, I suppose, a very good thing. So let's take a peek what the precious metals are doing. We have gold up $28.20, $1,765. We were $5 higher earlier in the day, so not a bad day for gold, $28.20. Silver is up 45 cents at $25.95. That was over 26 at one point in time. Platinum was up 24.2% at $1,202. Palladium was up $66 at $2,806. The USDX today is 91.64. Crude oil is up 22 at 63.37. And the paper markets today, you know, it topped 34,000 for the first time. And what we call for some blowout economic data. That's what the headlines read, blowout economic data. So the Dow is up 304 points at 34,035. S&P was up 45 at 4,170. The NASDAQ was up 180 at 14,038. And, you know, Dave, it's just, let's see, do I have the 10-year here? 1.55 on the 10-year. And that's pretty much it. And, there's a lot of things that are going on, you know, behind the scenes, the amount of money and so forth. And I think I lost, here we go, I lost my paperwork here. But some of that blowout economic data that everyone is so happy about, all based on stimulus checks. So let's give the people the money to have a good economy. Mm-hmm. So you have advanced retail sales rose 9.8% for the month. This is from the Commerce Department today. That compared to the Dow Jones estimate of 6.1% gain and an actual decline of 2.7% in February. We have sporting goods, clothing, food, beverage. They led the gains in spending and contributed to the best month for retail since May of 2020. And there was a separate report showed that the first-time filings for unemployment insurance plunged, with the Labor Department reporting 576,000 new jobless claims for the week that ended April 10th. Now, that was the lowest total since the early days of the pandemic, represented a sharp decline. If we remember, the previous week was 769,000. So, good thing. I want people to work. You know, we do want these folks to get back to work so they don't have to take stimulus checks anymore. But $1,400 was pretty much spent very aggressively. And, of course, that all came out of the $1.9 trillion rescue plan. But most of that goes for pork, but hey. But so there you go, Dave.
There you go, Melody. Probably important to keep in mind that this retail sales surge was big in the restaurant and bar industry, which has literally been pummeled during the pandemic. That saw over 13% surge in sales. And they're attributing that largely to the relaxing of restrictions in most states. Sporting goods spending, the highest percentage gain at 23.5%. Next, clothing and accessories at 18, and motor vehicle parts and dealers at 15. Now, it's being interpreted, the numbers, that these retail sales, just another sign that consumers overall are more willing to spend right now, particularly those at the middle and lower end of the income scale. We know from prior reports that those at the upper ends of the income spectrum have tended to save their stimulus checks. Economist Michael Pierce at Capital Economics said spending will almost certainly drop back in April as some of the stimulus boost wears off. But with the vaccination rollout proceeding at a record pace, he continued, we expect overall consumption growth to continue rebounding rapidly in the second quarter as well. A recent report from the New York Fed suggests that stimulus recipients expect to save about 42% of their checks and spend 25. What's that, 77? What about the other 23%, Melody? Where's that going? Isn't it just an either-or kind of thing? I have to think about that sometime. Following the first round of checks last year, consumers reportedly saved 35% and spent 29%. Now, as the economy has been showing signs of a rebound here and there, consumers have had to deal with the strongest signs yet of inflationary pressures building. Even though we know the number is much higher than this, the government CPI rose to 2.6% in March from a year ago, thanks in part, if not large part, to a 9% surge in gasoline prices, Melody.
Well, you know, the economic data today that showed more signs of thawing in the labor market, but, you know, the non-farm payroll addition of 916,000 in March, you know, did bring some more hope that, you know, things are getting a little bit better. People are getting their jobs. But despite the big decline in weekly claims, though, continuing claims were a little changed at 3.73 million. The four-week moving average for weekly claims declined to 683,000, but that is also the lowest since March 14th, Dave.
Well, again, there seems to be a trend developing, but, you know, let's wait at least 6 to 8 more weeks, I would suggest, until, you know, you can say anything more definitive, because this has still been a roller coaster ride. And we're still in very uncertain times. Now, the total of those receiving benefits under all government jobless programs fell by over a million, still to 16.9. That's 17 million people still receiving some kind of unemployment benefit as of the end of March. Now, about half the weekly decline in filings, the weekly filings, I believe, came from California, although I think Ohio and Texas were in there as well. Now, a pair of other economic indicators, one of which we'll talk about more about in a second, also turned in stronger readings than expected. And one of them, the Philadelphia Fed's manufacturing survey, registered a reading of 50.2, representing the difference between companies reporting expansion and those seeing contraction. Now, that was well ahead of the estimate of 42, and it's the highest reading, actually, since March of 1973. Very interesting. A reading of 50, as seasoned listeners know, indicates an expansion in that sector. So we're just seeing a very slight expanding manufacturing sector, according to the Philadelphia Fed, Melody.
Well, you know, business activity, excuse me, business activity was little changed in New York State, and that's according to firms responding to the latest Empire State Manufacturing Survey. The headline General Business Condition Index held steady at 3.5. New orders and shipments had edged higher. And there's a little bit of an explanation for some of this we'll talk about, too, here in just a little bit. Would you like to, you know, finish that up, Dave?
Well, there was essentially little growth in manufacturing in New York State in this most recent survey. I mean, the general business conditions were similar previous months' readings. About a quarter of respondents reported that conditions had improved over the month. Another quarter reported that they had worsened. Now, if you recall, the New York State Empire Manufacturing Survey is popular, and we mention it every month because it is a widely known proxy for the manufacturing sector as a whole in the country. It gives sort of a good idea even though it's a lagging indicator about how things are going on elsewhere. We know that new orders were up in this survey, pointing to a modest increase in shipments. The number of employees happened to fall, pointing to, although that points to ongoing gains in employment, I'm not sure why. The average work week was little change, but showed another small increase in total hours worked. Again, the biggest rises are being seen in prices. Prices paid rose to its highest level in 2 years. So the index for future new orders and shipments slightly up. Now, employment levels in the average work week are expected to continue to increase in the months ahead as joblessness is expected to continue to decline. Still, there's some degree of leap of faith involved in numbers like these, Melody. But again, if you follow them, even on a monthly basis, they do tend to fall together to just enhance our overall perspective.
I have a question.
Uh-oh.
Well, business inventories in the U.S. increased pretty solid in February. And, you know, it suggests that restocking could again contribute to economic growth in the first quarter. Yeah. You know, we talked about jobs coming back. And when do we get to the point of determining? I mean, here you had most of this nation closed a year ago. So all the jobs coming back, or jobs that were lost, where do we find the, when we see new jobs being created? I mean, do we have to go all the way back to the low employment, when we were at 3.2 unemployment rate? Or, I mean, where do we find the equilibrium or to where we can gauge?
An excellent question. And an important one. And I mean, my response would be that indeed you do have to go back to the low point. That is the when the U3 unemployment rate was said to be at 3.2 or 3.5%. But we don't look at that number per se. We look at total number of people employed versus the total number of people in available for work. And I guess that would take us back to January or February of. It might even take us back. I have to look a little more closely to the late 2019. But that's. And it's an excellent point because, we got to beware. We could be tempted to think that things are a lot better in the job market than they actually are. If we start comparing it to, say, the peak unemployment level, in the middle of last year. When unemployment, U3 was close to 15 and U6 was, in the 20s. And that's certainly not insignificant, particularly for those people who've been out of work since then. But no, I think that's exactly the right question to ask, and I believe that's the right way to pose how we look at that going forward.
Yeah, because, when you come from a complete stop, everything's going to look great. Numbers are going to be good and so forth. And then you still have to count in, what if that stimulus wasn't there?
Yeah.
Where would we be?
We'd be in a deep hole.
And how far can this, in this last bill, we're looking at where, and again, monthly checks are being sent out for children.
Yep.
Until the end of December.
Yep.
And they're just not little checks.
Nope.
What do these children need checks for?
Well, their parents. They're for food, for care.
Which tells me things are not rosy in this country.
Indeed, they're not.
And things are not getting better. People aren't going to work. Some can go to work and don't want to go to work. What has happened over this past year to get those kinds of ideas that we don't have to work? We don't want to work.
Put it another way. A lot of particularly formerly working mothers, had to decide between continue work and let their school-aged children remain home alone because their schools weren't open. I think we could see a lot of this revert. I'm going to say revert forward to the new normal when. Virtually every school, if not every school, has reopened at some point. That'll be a big telling story, I think, in terms of what happens to the job situation, particularly with respect to working moms. I wasn't arguing, by the way. I wasn't arguing.
No, I know you weren't.
For
I know you
or
weren't.
Against.
Right.
Or against the child tax credit.
Right. No, I know that. And that wasn't. It just goes to show we're just not as rosy as what everything seems to be. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody the rest of the program as she maintains the office and take care of customer orders. Well, I'll tell you what, that music bringing back the second segment, that really cheers me up. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm visualizing some of these national broadcasters who stand in their studios, and that music just wants to get me standing. So I might have to look for a new location in the home studio here. Thanks, Todd, for keeping us smiling. In any event, just briefly here, if you missed this news, the U.S. has imposed a raft of new sanctions on Russia, including long-feared restrictions on buying new sovereign debt. That's in retaliation for misconduct alleged misconduct related to the Solar Winds hack, as well as efforts to disrupt the 2020 U.S. elections. The new measure sanctions 32 entities and individuals, including government and intelligence officials, Russians, that is, six Russian companies that provide support to the Russian government's hacking operations. The U.S. is also expelling 10 Russian diplomats working in Washington. That's an unusually large number. That figure includes some intelligence officers. Biden administration's also barring U.S. financial institutions, this is the big one, from participating in the primary market for new debt issued by the Russian Central Bank or by its finance ministry and sovereign wealth fund. Those limits would take effect starting June 14th. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan described the moves as proportionate measures to defend American interest in response to harmful Russian actions, blah, 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 blah. So be interesting. It seems the tensions are intensifying between our two countries, not to mention China, particularly coming the past few weeks over Russian military buildup near Ukraine. So we'll see what happens now. I guess it's Putin. It's your move. Moving on, the setting for 2021 that's being put forth by the government, Wall Street, and other mainstream types want us to believe this: a powerful growth trajectory fueled by an influx of government spending as the U.S. rebounds from the pandemic and recession will head into the fastest economic acceleration in almost four decades. My response is, well, even if that's so, after that, then what? I mean, the path beyond this supposed rocket-fueled year looks far less clear. One-time spending has rarely been the catalyst for long-term growth. Fiscal and monetary policy that now serve as irresistible tailwinds could indeed soon turn into headwinds. On the other side of this burst of activity will be an economy beset by inequality and a two-speed recovery that likely is going to take more than the occasional government transfer payment. That means no one will be happy. And so while GDP growth this year could reach as high as 7%, maybe even higher, as they're saying, don't get used to it. An economic reckoning is likely ahead. Some, like Melody Cederstrom, and others believe an economic reset is coming. Joe Lavornia, who's chief economist at Natixis, says, I don't see growth as being particularly durable. The economy is going to slow a lot more next year than people think and probably will be well under 3%. Lavornia, who was the chief economist for the Trump National Economic Council, sees a number of obstacles, many of them policy related. In the immediate political climate, trillions in direct payments have helped buoy consumer spending and imports. But the trend so far has been for robust credit and debit card spending to cool off once the initial jolt from the stimulus checks ebbs. But looming ahead are higher taxes for corporations and wealthier Americans. Also, the Biden administration's intense focus on addressing climate issues likely will add to the regulatory burden that's particularly tough on smaller businesses. Ornia said, at this point, I don't see businesses making a big longer-term commitment either to factory buildouts or anything else that would have a long shelf life because you're not sure what the regulatory and tax environments are going to look like. And of course, there's the issue of those on the bottom rungs of the economic ladder. While the transfer payments help in the short run, employment data continue to indicate a slow recovery for lower earners. There's stubbornly high weekly jobless claims, despite the most current reports plunge, and a gap remaining of at least 3 million hospitality jobs that appear a long way from coming back, if they ever will, because of the tens of thousands of businesses across the country that have closed. Fed estimates still have the jobless rate for the bottom quintile in the 20% range. And even that number is almost certainly low. Everyone's expecting a turnkey economy. We just need to reopen and move on, and things will go perfectly. Well, those are the words of economist Neela Richardson at ADP, which circulates the widely followed monthly count of private payroll jobs. She continued, I don't think you'll get turnkey. There's been significant scarring in the labor market, and there's been damage done to a lot of consumers. Richardson's in the camp of those seeing a K-shaped recovery, yours truly included, where those on the higher rungs have maintained or even thrived during the pandemic, while those at the bottom have actually lost ground. Jerome Powell said in an interview on Sunday's 60 Minutes that the Fed's attuned to the issues confronting service industry workers and pledged to keep the policy focus in that direction. But it hasn't helped thus far, the Fed. And in fact, the Fed's expanded QE has no doubt led to a widening of the income gap over the past year, not a narrowing. Plus, Fed officials believe they can continue to press the accelerator to the floor without risking a troublesome rise in inflation, even as consumer prices rise a measly 2.6% in March from the year prior. In fact, using government methodologies that were in effect in 1990 and 1980, respectively, the CPI is probably between 6 and 10%. Powell and his fellow policymakers see the recent inflation trends as temporary and the results of supply chain issues that will gradually go away. But again, the Fed, and particularly the Powell Fed, has run into trouble before when trying to forecast over the long term. Remember, just in late 2018, the Fed had to backpedal from plans to continue raising rates when issues relating to the trade war hit the global economy. And a little over a year later, the Fed's pledge to stop cutting rates went away when the pandemic hit. So while defenders of the Fed might say that, well, those were unforeseen events, that's the point. Making these long-term policy pledges is a Sisyphean task. I love that word. In a big, bad global economy where the sand shifts so frequently. Blitz, who's the chief U.S. economist at T.S. Lombard, says the biggest risk to the expansion is the Fed. The puppet master is trying to control a puppet they don't have any control over. Bill, Blitz thinks the Fed's policy pivot last year, in which it pledged not to tighten until it sees actual inflation rather than just forecast, is the right thing. Namely, because, quote, their forecasts stink. But monetary policy from the Fed and fiscal policy from the Congress overall is likely to stay loose until the economy's underlying issues are addressed. Everybody recognizes the political costs of ignoring the middle now are too high. Both parties are sitting on the knife's edge. Who can do the best through fiscal spending at winning back that independent, middle-of-the-road vote? That seems to be the question. After all, that's what policymaking, especially fiscal policymaking, is all about these days, right? Now, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Todd, we'll have to think of some music at some point in the future to introduce this segment. This week's topic is the not-so-light topic of drugs and addiction. New data just out are showing that more Americans died of drug overdoses in the year ending September 2020 than in any 12-month period since the opioid epidemic began. The stubborn increase of such deaths of despair, as it's they've come to be known as, shows that the opioid epidemic still has room to grow and that some of the social distancing steps we took to rein in the pandemic may have brought these deadly, unintended side effects. More than 88,000 Americans died from drug overdoses in that 12-month period. It's according to federal data released this week. That represents a 29% increase in overdose deaths for the months between October 2019 and September 2020 compared to the prior year. While overdose deaths from drugs had begun rising in the months leading up to the start of the pandemic, that was after dipping slightly in 2018 for the first time in years, the biggest spike in deaths occurred in April of May last year when shutdowns were strictest. A particular note, while the earliest years of the opioid epidemic were worst among white Americans, in particularly rural and suburban areas, black Americans in urban areas are now suffering disproportionately. Experts connect some of the increase in overdose deaths to the social isolation and temporary closure of many treatment programs during the pandemic. One study found that people used drugs more frequently during the pandemic and often did so alone. And that, of course, put them at greater risk of dying of an overdose. At least 25% of syringe service programs reported having to close sites because of distancing policies during the pandemic, and nearly half had to restrict operating hours. And as it was, they were located in very few American cities. The bottom line is we worry about the very rare side effects of some COVID vaccines. We shouldn't forget about the deadly unintended consequences of other measures designed to control the pandemic. Now, before we move away from this, I have to admit I have a personal attachment to this opioid epidemic. One of my kid brothers has struggled with heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, and methamphetamine abuse for 25 years. And that's had explosive consequences for him and my family. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Not So Levity is Golden. Now, just sticking with this in a related story, President Biden and Congress appear set to extend a Trump administration decision to impose harsher minimum sentence for people caught with fentanyl. Step opponents argue would harken back to, well, Joe Biden's reputation as a leading drug warrior. I should say anti-drug warrior, even as critical Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia pushes to make this change permanent. According to Hillary Shelton of the NAACP, the Biden administration, its leaders, and economists are faced with their first major test of criminal justice reform. If they choose to extend this Trump-era policy, she continued, it will increase mass incarceration and the over-policing and incarceration of people of color and will be a missed position on Biden's campaign promises. At issue here, of course, is the classification of fentanyl. It's a drug the CDC has highlighted as a key reason that fatal opioid overdoses spiked last year, as I just mentioned. The drug, which is more powerful than morphine and used legally as a pharmaceutical to treat patients with severe pain, has long been classified as Schedule 2, making unauthorized use of it or manufacture illegal. Starting in 2018, the Trump administration began an emergency classification of fentanyl and a wide selection of other drugs with similar chemical structures as Schedule 1 drugs. And that means possession and distribution now carry harsher mandatory minimum sentences. Congress extended that classification in early 2020, and it's set to expire in early May. A spokesperson for the Office of National Drug Control Policy said the administration would support an extension. It emphasized the need to find an agreement to address legitimate concerns related to mandatory minimums and researcher access to these substances. It's easy to see how the fight over fentanyl classification could become an intra-Democratic Party battle. More than 100 criminal justice and drug policy advocacy groups signed on to a letter last week opposing the extension. It pushes key members of Congress to let the emergency classification expire and instead focus on using public health to battle the epidemic. On the other side, there's Manchin, who's teamed up with Senator Rob Portman, a Republican from Ohio, to push legislation to make the classification permanent. Manchin, as we now know, has emerged as a key decision maker for the fate of the Biden administration's larger agenda on everything from gun safety legislation to infrastructure and immigration. Let us know how you feel about this. Should harsher sentences for fentanyl be extended? Email me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com and say yes or no. I'll read your response. Hey, that's it for this segment. Stick around. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TheTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. We're going to finish up today's program with some comments on the, ongoing comments on the cryptocurrency situation. But first, some other important news. At long last, the U.S. Senate voted the closest vote, I believe, for Biden confirmee, voted 53-45 yesterday to confirm former derivative markets regulator Gary Gensler as head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Hopefully, and we've got to emphasize for now, hopefully, spelling tougher regulatory oversight for Wall Street. Gensler's expected to be sworn in as SEC chair in the coming days. A former Goldman Sachs banker and currently a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, Gensler most recently led Joe Biden's transition plan for financial industry oversight. He also served under Obama as chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, where he was largely praised for having the backs of investors the Wall Street companies. Wall Street banks, brokers, funds, and public companies enjoyed 4 years of easier rules and enforcement over the last 4 years, but that ended with Biden's appointment of SEC Commissioner Allison Lee as the interim chair just a few months ago. She wasted no time unraveling Wall Street-friendly policies using quick-fix legal tactics like beefing up the agency's enforcement team and pursuing new corporate disclosure requirements. Gensler, who developed a reputation as a tough operator willing to stand up to powerful Wall Street interests during a stint at the CFTC, is expected to take an equally tough stance. Last month, he told Congress that he would pursue new regulations for cryptocurrencies, which he said can be a catalyst for change, but pose investor protection concerns. He also said he would explore new climate and political spending corporate disclosures. Barb Roper, who's the chief investor advocate at the Consumer Federation of America, said, "Gary Gensler has the perfect mix of market expertise, regulatory experience, and commitment to the public interest." Now, given all the risky investments and other highly questionable activities of many of the too-big-to-fail banks and other multinationals, let's hope so. Now, Melody alluded to this. Let me just bring it up one more time. Eligible parents will start getting a little monthly financial help starting in July. IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig has confirmed that the IRS will be able to begin the payments at that time. For the latest pandemic bill signed into law in March, parents received a tax credit for each child when they filed their federal tax returns each year. The credit was paid as part of their tax refund. Last month's $1.9 trillion stimulus relief measure increased the amount of the credit and allowed for its monthly distribution in cash to help families with their budgeting, especially families driven into debt by the pandemic. But with the tax filing deadline pushed back to May 17th, the IRS had warned that it was doubtful the payments to millions of Americans would begin on schedule. But at a Senate hearing on Tuesday, Rettig said the IRS could meet the original date. The monthly payment parents receive will depend on how many children they have, as well as their household income. Individuals earning less than $75,000 or married couples earning $150,000 or less will get the full benefit, which has been raised from $2,000 a year to either, well, I should say, to between $3,000 and $3,600. The new law increases the tax credit to $3,000 per child between the ages of 6 to 17 and $3,600 per child under the age of 6 for the 2021 tax year. Parents making more than the income thresholds will still receive the original credit of $2,000 per child under age 17 for families making less than $200,000 annually for an individual, I should say, or $400,000 for couples filing married and joint. The new increased tax credit will come in the form of a monthly check from July through December this year. Thus, the monthly amount each family gets will range from $250 for older children and $300 for children under the age of 6. The other half of the tax credit will come in the form of a tax refund next year. Now, to receive a tax credit, parents must have filed a 2020 tax return. Reddick said the tax agency won't have the information required to distribute the payments if it doesn't have a return on file. But aside from filing a federal return, there are no other requirements. There's also no limit on the number of children in a family eligible for the payments. So good news there on that front. Let me just quickly go here. Then we'll go on to cryptocurrencies. After inking a deal to work together almost 3 years ago, supermarket chain Kroger and UK online grocer Ocado today took the wraps off the first major product of that deal. Kroger's launched a new Ocado-powered customer fulfillment center in Monroe, Ohio, outside of Cincinnati. It's a gigantic warehouse covering 375,000 square feet and thousands of products for packing and delivering Kroger orders from online shoppers. Now, here's the kick. Built with a giant grid along the floor, the shed, as Ocado calls its warehouses, will feature 1,000 robots working alongside 400 human employees to pick, sort, and move items. It's expected to process as much as $700 million in sales annually, equivalent to the sales of 20 brick and mortar stores. So interesting, the move toward automation is transcending to robots right before our eyes, 1,000 of them. I wonder how many human equivalents. I have a feeling we're going to start seeing that in years to come. Human equivalents that will keep off the payroll. All right, let's finish, as I said, with cryptocurrencies. Bitcoiners, Ethereum owners, Coinbasers now are in a triumphant mood these days. The price is near all-time highs. Coinbase, which just went public, just in the sky with the initial valuation. Institutional interest apparently continues to grow. Many of the naysayers who mocked it over the last decade are kind of, in some respects, humiliated and having fun staying poor. However, in their drive towards victory, there's one recurring Bitcoin talking point that has to be debunked. And this is said not tongue-in-cheek. It is said in the context of, hey, we have a fiat currency. Like it or not, we're not on a gold standard anymore. But this is where we are. And starting from that point, the claim that Bitcoin is now the fifth biggest currency in the world and is even larger than the British pound, well, is, let's quote Colonel Harry Potter again, horse hockey. This idea of ranking currencies based on the size of their so-called monetary base means the yen and the euro, too, are both larger than the U.S. dollar. Look, if you ever get to a point in life when you're ranking the size of currencies and somehow you stumble on a measure that purports to show that the yen and the euro are larger than the dollar, well, you need to just stop everything and reevaluate, you know, how you got to that point. Because everybody knows that's nonsense, or should know, and you should start looking for another measure. Seriously, that fact alone should tell you that you've stumbled on a very wrong way to measure currencies. And yet, within the Bitcoin community, rankings like this one's are proliferating. Now, we could stop right here, but it's worth powering forward for a few minutes to just explain the levels of wrongness at play. First, what are we even talking about when we're talking about the monetary base like this? As Matthew Mazinski's explained, it's a combination of coin and cash out there, plus the reserves that banks hold at monetary authorities, like the Fed. The problem is that reserves is just not that useful as a measure of anything. All it simply reflects these days is how much QE, the Fed or whatever central bank you're talking about, has done. And QE, at its basics, is a swap of one type of government liability, for example, a government bond like a treasury, for another type of government liability, i.e. reserves. It's not a measure of currency size. It simply reflects how the government has chosen to structure its own liabilities. Now, Bitcoiners may admit that it's not a perfect measure, but then they say it's conceptually useful. Because just as fiat currency has M1, M2, and M3, reflecting broadening forms of the money, so does Bitcoin, which has a base layer, the blockchain, but also has layer two payments whereby transactions can be conducted off-chain and then settled ultimately on the chain itself. You don't understand that? You probably shouldn't be investing in it. You can actually think of the newly public Coinbase as offering centralized layer two payments because they enable instant Bitcoin transfers between Coinbase users. Those transactions aren't actually registered on the blockchain itself. They're just reflected in Coinbase's own internal ledger. There are also other solutions, though, such as the decentralized Lightning Network that allow multiple parties to enter into transactions, which only later get properly settled on the blockchain. But while it's tempting to compare the levels of Bitcoin and fiat currencies this way, the analogy doesn't take us very far. The flaw is this. Bitcoin's second layer solutions need the dollar value of the base layer to grow in order to scale. You can't have billions of layer two Bitcoin transactions until the base layer is worth several billions. With fiat money, no such constraint exists. Everyday dollar payments scale just as well today as they did before the Great Recession, when the amount of Fed reserves were much smaller, because QE wasn't a thing just yet. Dollar transactions don't need a large base of money at all, whereas Bitcoin transactions absolutely do. So, the euro and yen aren't bigger than the dollar. That argument fails conceptually on its face, since base money isn't a measure of a currency size. And it fails logically. Base money measures aren't analogous structurally to Bitcoin's base layer, because for Bitcoin, growth in the base is needed in order to scale payments. And this isn't the case for fiat money. If Bitcoiners are going to insist on comparing their so-called currency to the big fiats, they ought to use the proper measures. For example, what's the Bitcoin share of international payments? What's the Bitcoin share of central bank reserves? How much Bitcoin-denominated debt is there? These are the logical types of ways to rank and compare money. These rankings show that Bitcoin, by almost any measure, is still incredibly tiny. Now, it's true more and more people use Bitcoin as an investment vehicle, and that it's getting pretty big. I mean, at $1.2 trillion, it's smaller than Alphabet, but larger than Facebook. It's also around the value of all New York City real estate, which was pegged last year at around $1.4 trillion. I mean, pretty impressive as an investment or savings vehicle, no doubt. But so far, as a currency, it just doesn't measure up yet to the big guys. So if Bitcoin ever gathers real steam, as a way that people pay for things, which is starting to come into being, we can revisit the currency ranking side seriously at that time. Until then, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are still a largely unknown entity and are nothing more or little more than a highly risky speculative investment. Now, if you want something with inherent fundamental value, ladies and gentlemen, stick with gold and silver.
Phew.
That is a mouthful, I know. I appreciate you your attention. And again, if you have any comments, particularly if you disagree, or if you're a Bitcoin investor and no more than the average Joe or Sally, including myself, I might add, again, please drop me an email at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's all we have for today's program. I want to thank our producer and engineer, Todd, for keeping us on the straight and narrow. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch. Also, be on the lookout in your email inboxes for our weekly Water Rush of Gold and Silver blog. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening, and please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye.
Have a plan. If I got me a welcome.